This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Massachusetts state primaries are upon us. Think back to February, March, if you voted in New Hampshire or Massachusetts then. Did you ever imagine it would be this way? Now, about two-thirds of the people planning to vote have already mailed in their ballots. Nevertheless, hundreds of thousands are expected to cast their votes in person today, and Massachusetts Secretary of State William Galvin told WBUR this morning that they shouldn't be worried about safety at the polls.
I think you're going to see it as safe as going to the supermarket. And I think we've all been to the supermarket now since the pandemic has started. We've seen the precautions that have been taken in those situations, and I think you're going to see there's even greater precautions being taken at the polls.
So what's it like out there today? WBUR has a slate of reporters out at the polls, and joining me now is WBUR reporter Simone Rios, joining from East Boston. Hi there, Simone.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. You do this for us every year, and I want to know, where have you been today, and how does it compare to the mood from last time?
You know, I'm in East Boston right now in the high school gymnasium. There are several precincts that are located here, and I have to say, it doesn't feel that different. Oftentimes at these polling places in the middle of the day, there's not a lot of activity, and there's plenty of space for people to move around. I would say Bill Galvin's assertion that it's as safe as a supermarket is probably true, at least at this East Boston High School where I am now. There's a steady flow of people coming in. Really plenty of room for people to socially distance. As you pointed out, a lot of people have already voted, so I don't see it changing that much, although, you know, that could change as we get closer to a little later this evening.
One thing I'm curious about, we've heard about a push to have younger people work the polls because they may be less vulnerable to the implications of catching the coronavirus. Who is there and has been there all day?
Yeah, so the guy at the front, poll worker, he's working for his first time because he was concerned about that shortage. So he came in and he's working. I think he came in at 5 in the morning and said he's going to leave around 9. But there's a slate of different measures that are in place. There's a bottle of sanitizer. Everybody who comes in is urged to use that sanitizer. They're giving away face masks, although the poll worker told me that literally every person who's come in has been wearing a face mask. The Boston Elections Department is giving workers PPE, personal protective equipment. They have these sort of four-way voting booths, and half of those are closed off, so nobody can vote right next to one another. The pens that are being offered, you know, as they're returned, they're sanitized before going back to the voters. And the people I talked to today, Tiziana, said they feel safe voting in Boston today.
Tell us more about that, what you're hearing from voters who have decided to vote in person.
Yeah, one of the big the big stories of today and tomorrow, perhaps, is the Markey Kennedy race. It seems to be on a lot of people's minds. I spoke to one voter, Walter Villatoro. He's a unionized hotel worker who backs Markey.
He's already been there. He's been working with a lot of the unions. And he got more, I will say, not that Kenny doesn't have an experience, but he's been there already, so he knows what the problems are, you know, the union is having right now.
Yeah, and he said that he really feels that Markey, if he's reelected, is really going to step up his efforts supporting his union, Local 26. On the other side, I spoke to an East Boston resident, Charlene Goodwin. She's a meter maid with the city, and for her, Kennedy clearly has been more present. She just hasn't seen a lot of Markey since he's been in the Senate.
He actually came out and spoke with everyone, took time with us, so it kind of convinced me to go for him, go towards him. And Markey, on the other hand, the whole time he's been in office, I don't think I've seen his face around here, ever.
Yeah, so, you know, this is a big race. And in some ways, I'll say, you know, it's part of this insurgent trend of younger Democrats unseating more establishment folks. But, you know, in other ways, a lot of people see Markey as really the more progressive one and not enough of an upgrade to warrant unseating Markey. I spoke to two well-known progressive activists here in Boston, in East Boston, and they were split on this question. One voted for Kennedy because she says, as the previous voter we heard from said, that she really hasn't seen much of Markey. And that's something that she expects that Kennedy would change if he's elected.
Well, that is going to be fascinating to watch unfold. That's WBUR reporter Simone Rios joining us from East Boston. Thank you, Simone.
Yeah, thank you.
And listeners, Simone will be a part of WBUR's live coverage tonight, too, reporting from Joe Kennedy's Watertown campaign headquarters. You'll be able to catch him there. Let's turn now to the western half of the state, where they're also voting in the widely covered first district Democratic primary between incumbent Congressman Richard Neal and Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse. Dusty Christensen is a reporter with the Daily Hampshire Gazette and is in Holyoke today. Hi, Dusty.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's the mood like out there, Dusty, and how crowded are the polls?
You know, I was surprised to see how many people are streaming into polling sites in our part of the district. I'm sitting in Holyoke right now in front of the Metcalf School on Northampton Street, and there seems to be a pretty steady stream of people similar to previous elections. I spoke with the city clerk, Brenna Murphy-McGee, earlier today at 1:30. She said that voter turnout, including mail-in ballots, was already up to 23%. That's way higher than the 13% who turned out for the last Democratic primary in 2018. So there has actually been a surprising number of people coming to vote in person here in the district. People are obviously very excited about this congressional race between Morse and Neal.
Well, you are in Alex Morse's town, the challenger. He's the mayor of Holyoke. Are you hearing pretty wide support for him there?
You know, it's interesting. He certainly has plenty of supporters in Holyoke. Morse has obviously been good about turning out grassroots support in his mayoral campaigns as he's won them since he was 22 years old when he first won the mayorship. However, there, of course, like any city, is opposition to him as well. Holyoke politics are deeply divided, and particularly after 2019, when the city went through a very contentious, controversial ballot question over whether to build two new middle schools. Much of the city's elected officials supported that effort, but it was defeated at the ballot box in a landslide. It will be interesting to see to what extent Morse and other incumbents take a hit from that this year, after having supported a ballot question that ended up being so unpopular with voters. It still remains to be seen, but I'm seeing plenty of Morse supporters in East Hampton, in West Hampton, and then out here in Holyoke, standing, cheering voters into polling stations and hoping their candidate wins.
And Dusty, in our last 30 seconds or so, what's the mood you are getting from voters?
The mood is honestly one of excitement, no matter who they're voting for. We've seen every possible combination of voters in the senatorial race as well as the congressional one. But people seem very informed. I spoke to a longtime political consultant in Springfield, Anthony Signoli, who doesn't have a horse in this race, said that he's been doing polling in the district, has never seen a race where people are so informed and so motivated to get out and vote for their candidate. So we're going to see big voter turnout today, and it remains to be seen who that will benefit.
All right. Well, thanks for giving us a feel for things out there. That's Dusty Christensen in Holyoke, a reporter with the Daily Hampshire Gazette. Thanks, Dusty.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, let's turn to WBUR's Callum Borchers. Callum is in Holliston. Hey there, Callum.
Hey there, Tiziana.
So I know you're in Holliston now. Where have you been today? What have you been seeing? Who's turned up to vote in person? Why? Tell us about it.
Well, I was in Hopkinton, which is the starting line of the Boston Marathon, and that could be a metaphor for a long day, Tiziana, depending on how the counting goes. You know, it's also part of the 4th Congressional District, where there's a very crowded race to succeed Joe Kennedy, of course. And what I observed was, I would call a trickle of voters. You know, we heard Galvin say earlier today on our air that about two-thirds of the ballots he's expecting were cast before today, and that's consistent with why I was observing. So who's left? I mean, people who waited a long time to make up their mind to the last minute, you know, and people who felt comfortable voting in person. People like Phyllis Doig. She's 57, from Hopkinton, of course. She chose to vote in person, she told me, because she just had every confidence that it would be handled well.
It was like a regular election day, just a different entrance to go in. There was plenty of space, plenty of sanitizer, and I found it to be a very good experience.
And part of the reason, of course, there was plenty of space was because so many people had voted early or by mail. But we know that this new process wasn't smooth for everybody, Tiziana. I also met Vic Prati in Hopkinton. He applied for a mail-in ballot, but says he didn't receive one. So he came out to vote in person instead.
It's a social responsibility. You should. There's no way you can skip this, right? This makes a big difference. You have to make it.
And he said that after casting his ballot that he feels safe voting in person because of the mask requirements. I saw everybody was following that guidance, and also the voting booths were well spaced out.
So we just heard a minute ago Dusty Christensen talking about the enthusiasm he was hearing for people regardless of who they were voting for. Any voters particularly vocal about who they're supporting today where you've been?
Yeah, I mean, the Ed Markey supporters that you meet tend to be very enthusiastic for their candidate, I would say. I also ran into Alan Casey's wife, Vanessa Kirsch. So she's very enthusiastic, of course, for her candidate. also, their dog, Zuzu, was in Hopkinton. Zuzu can't vote, but he also is very loyal. Casey, of course, is one of the candidates in that crowded fourth congressional district field. And Kirsch described, you know, what it's been like for her and her husband to campaign during a global pandemic.
Well, it's not what we expected when we got into this campaign. He's the kind of guy who loves to go and hug everybody, even his Italian-American side comes out. And so it's just been really hard to do it over Zoom and phone calls instead of, you know, being able to be out there with the voters every day.
So Vanessa Kirsch there, she told me that she voted in person early in their hometown of Brookline, and she said the experience felt pretty normal to her.
So, Kellen, this year is, atypical for so many reasons, and that includes probably tonight, because there's a chance we may not know who wins some of these races tonight when we usually would. Massachusetts Secretary of State William Galvin told WBUR he hopes they'll have results out soon, but that his office still has a lot of work ahead of them.
Hopefully, we're going to have the ability to count them rapidly. One of the problems, however, of course, is just the volume has been so great to afford convenience to the voters. Obviously, it was very difficult for many of the local officials.
What are you expecting? Do we have an idea of when we might know?
You know, my guess is that some of the less competitive races may be called tonight. My best guess on, like, the Senate race and the fourth is sometime tomorrow. I do think the election officials are going to push really hard, perhaps working all through the night, to get this counting done. Because, as Galvin has pointed out a few times, his office needs to print the general election ballot really soon. So there's not a lot of time to dilly-dally here.
How much of a sense do you have, Callum, that this is really a dry run for how things will go in the general in November?
Well, you know, it is in some ways. I mean, it's similar, but the big difference, of course, is that these primary ballots had to be received by today. There was no grace period for getting it postmarked. There is a grace period after the general election in November, and so we may actually have even more of a lag in the fall. And, of course, the other twist is that, you know, it'll be the presidential race that will be the central focus in November, and that's an entirely different system with the Electoral College. And so, you know, if the count is slow in the swing states that are really going to determine the outcome, we may not know the winner of the presidential race for several days. It could, in fact, actually be less dramatic in the Senate race in November than it is today, because this Democratic primary today could be more competitive than the general election proves to be in November. The winner between Kennedy and Markey today, of course, is going to meet one of the Republicans, either Shiva Ayodure or Kevin O'Connor. They're facing off today.
And that's WBUR's Callum Borchers. Thanks, Callum.
Great to be with you.
It's September 1st, and that's a sort of unofficial start date for the college experience. We know university plans for their students as living and learning have varied, and we also know that those who have returned students to campus in the midst of this pandemic have generated a lot of debate and concern over the potential public health risks. But according to Peter Ubertasio, Dean of Arts and Sciences at Stonehill College, the benefits outweigh the risks as long as there's a well-thought-out plan in place. And he joins me now to talk more about that. Peter, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a couple of weeks into this new school year process, and obviously it's been a tough time for all of us, at least the last 6-8 months. How are you?
I'm tired, to be honest. I think I speak for a lot of my colleagues. It's a mixture of excitement. We're really thrilled to have our students back, whether they're here in person or joining us remotely. But it's been exhausting to try and put these plans together, you know, and to have to deal with public health issues in real time.
You know, I hear that so often. September 1st feels like the unofficial start of so many things, and yet so many people are going into it exhausted. Do you feel trepidation about that, Peter, like the ability to run the marathon is at risk?
You know, I do a little bit. I worry about our staff and faculty colleagues who haven't had a break. You know, normally the summer is a time to regroup, to maybe focus on scholarship, to really think about your classes in the fall. And we've all had to adapt so quickly to this new reality that people have been going nonstop. So, you know, we're trying to monitor with all of our folks here and approach this with a good deal of humbleness and grace and some humor to try and get everyone through.
I know you feel strongly that students should be on campus as long as it can be done with safety. And I know you recently wrote a piece comparing what you call sideline moments in sports to these benefits that you believe in of in-person learning. Can you make your case and talk about the sideline moments dimension of it?
Thank you. You know, I have athletes at home, and my son is a basketball player, and I've often marveled at the way the look on the faces of the kids when they're in a basketball team, when a coach calls the timeout, and they quickly gather around to get instruction. And I see the same look on my college students and their college athletics, right? And it's really fascinating. It's something about the way an athlete looks at a coach during those moments of high adrenaline. And you see something similar in the classroom experience, which is really only one part. It is the most crucial part of what happens in higher ed, but it's only one part. You see the, you know, minus the sweat, minus the adrenaline, students and faculty gathered on the sidelines, whether it's after class, walking to a faculty member's office, leaving a lab together, just conversing in a dining hall. You know, the student experience really does extend from the classroom, and we've lost that, you know, because of the pandemic. From March on, you know, we've been able to gather digitally in a classroom environment, which has been wonderful, and it's really important that we have those tools to use, but we haven't really been able to gather on the sidelines, and those moments are crucial.
Peter, what do you say to people who might say, I get it, and stipulated, understood, those moments are crucial, but the price we risk paying for them by putting people in congregant living and more concentrated in campuses than they would be studying from home isn't worth the trade-off?
Well, I don't think that you can do it in isolation, meaning I think you have to do it with a really well-thought-out and holistic approach to safety. And that is inclusive of things like testing. So we're testing every member of our community every week, face coverings, right? We are mandating face coverings in the classroom, on campus, really anywhere outside of the residence hall or if a student is dining. Physical distancing, cleanliness. We're disinfecting, you know, all high-touch areas, including classrooms and bathrooms, every night on campus, as well as encouraging you know, personal hygiene, hand washing, and we've got dispensers all over campus. So we've transformed our campuses in order to provide the safety that you need, I think, in order to return in a way that's appropriate. So I wouldn't, you know, I don't think you can do this and just say, well, these things are so important, so let's just have them back. We have to have them back in a way that as best we can guarantee the safety of all members of the community.
We've heard a lot of stories about universities making one set of decisions, the cities and towns that they're in not liking those decisions and pushing back. You know, we are in a public health situation where we're navigating these things together. So what's the right relationship between a college or a university and the city and or town it's located in making these decisions in advancing safety measures and in enforcement?
Yeah, it's a great question and one that I know keeps a lot of my colleagues around the country up at night. I don't know what the right relationship is. I think the right approach is constant communication and really being open to the concerns that municipalities have. There's really no substitute for that. You know, we have an important job to do in bringing our students back so they can continue their progress toward their degree. Cities and towns have an important job to do in keeping their residents safe, and there are lots of areas that we can agree upon. And so I think open and transparent communication is the way to get through this.
And if there's a listener out there who's a faculty member at Stonehill or even another university where students are coming back into the classroom saying, I feel huge pressure and I don't want to be in the classroom because I don't feel safe. Maybe I'm at risk or someone in my family is high risk. What is your message to them right now?
Well, I can only tell you what we've done at Stonehill. And what we've done here is to say, if you prefer to teach online, you can teach online. We haven't mandated in-person teaching from any of our faculty. And those that have chosen to teach online are teaching in just as a rigorous capacity as they were if they were on campus. Those who are on campus are teaching with models that work best for their safety. So we've physically distanced every classroom. We've added technology to all of our classrooms so that students, because we've also given our students a remote option and allowed them, if they prefer, to be home this semester but to access their courses remotely. So we've outfitted our classrooms with the technology that you need in order to do that. We've moved a good percentage of our classes fully online to accommodate, again, faculty and student concerns. And so I think that that approach has worked really well for us, and not mandating that the faculty return this fall has helped us reduce density in our buildings, which is another important thing to do to provide safety. Allowing students a remote option further reduced density in the residence halls and in our buildings. So we've lost a little bit of the Stonehill vibe, which is a very vibrant campus, and we've got a lot of students and faculty who are remote this semester. So we've lost a little bit of that, but we've gained in safety. And so I think, again, it's a humble approach. It really allows people to choose what they think is best for themselves and for their families, and at the same time, provide a rigorous education to our students.
Peter, as we've been following this over the months, one of the things that's been really striking is the increasing bitterness of the divide, both in primary and secondary education, over those who believe learners should be in classrooms now and those who believe they shouldn't. And I wonder, was that inevitable? Was it inescapable that we would have this bitter divide, or have we done something wrong somewhere along the way?
It's such a great question. I think that we live, even before the pandemic, as you know, we live in a bitter moment. And, we very quickly want to assume the worst intentions from others. And so, what we've tried to do here is to acknowledge that this is a difficult time and that there are a variety of ways to get at a solution. I think it is more difficult at the secondary and elementary level, to be perfectly honest, than it is at the higher ed level, where you can more easily adapt with a mixture of online, in-person, hybrid, or high flex. I think we recognize that at our level that it's just easier to institute that, and the stakes are so much higher for families at an elementary level because it goes to a daily schedule for a family. It goes to daycare, it goes to childcare. And so I think some of the bitterness that we're seeing is a reflection of what happens when you make a decision for a school system, all the dominoes that fall and the difficulty that many caregivers have as a result of that. So, I understand why that bitterness is there. I do think in my experience, again, it's a limited one here at Stonehill, that in listening to people and really trying to provide a safe educational experience, both remotely and in person, has helped avoid some of the bitterness that we're seeing elsewhere.
I'm going to shift gears in a minute, Peter, but before I do, I want to ask you just one last question on this, which is, what are you still missing that you are most looking forward to getting back at some point if we ever return to the old normal or some semblance of it from this new normal?
Yeah, I think I'm missing meeting with my colleagues in an impromptu way. I miss having students congregating around their faculty after class. I miss seeing each other's face. You learn so much about human interaction by being able to talk, converse, to debate ideas and readings and we're missing all of that. So, I teach on Monday afternoons, and I had a great session with my students yesterday. It was really so wonderful to have them back. But we're all fully, masked, and I have students joining remotely. And we all recognize that there's a little bit of our humanity that's missing as a result of that. And that's not even the big things, right? We're not doing theater this fall. You can't do music and singing the way that we're used to. You have to be more thoughtful just walking in and out of rooms than you had to be at the beginning of this year. And so I do think that we are all exhausted as a result of that and really look forward to a moment when we can just converse, give, take, chat, and not have to worry about this virus.
Yeah, I admit that sounds really good. I said I wanted to shift gears. You are well known as an astute political observer. And since it's primary day, I'm going to ask you about this Kennedy-Markey race that people are watching so closely. It's just the way it has flipped, where we've got this long-serving member of the congressional delegation almost running as an outsider against a Kennedy who is more than 30 years younger. What do you make of that race? What's the headline?
I think the headline is that it's still very difficult to unseat an incumbent member of Congress. And even in this moment, when we see incumbents losing primary fights around the country, still, more often than not, incumbents who are running for renomination are in fact renominated. That's one headline. I think if there's a second, Ed Markey found his voice after all of these years. In Congress, it took a really significant challenge for him to be able to articulate a passionate defense for his time in both the House and the Senate. And so he has surprised, I think, a lot of political observers. No matter how the race turns out tonight, it has surprised many people to hear this newly aggressive Ed Markey.
And Peter, historically, Kennedys and Massachusetts have won their elections. If Markey does win, what does that say about the power of the Kennedy name and the family in Massachusetts today?
Well, I think that the family, is still going to be incredibly well regarded here. There are just some dynamics in this particular race that were unusual. I think Congressman Kennedy is very much beloved by a lot of folks and has a bright future ahead. If he doesn't pull it off today, there are still possibilities for him down the road. I think it can be overstated a little bit, and this is a unusual challenge even for a member of the Kennedy family, right? It's a challenge against a fairly popular incumbent United States senator. And that is a very difficult thing to do. Now, Markey has flipped the script here by pulling in the support from the progressive base of the Democratic Party in a way that has reshaped the race. But I don't think this spells the end of the Kennedy family's public service, and I don't think it spells the end of Joe Kennedy's commitment to public service either.
And Peter, just in our last 30 seconds or so, what else are you watching for today or maybe tonight or maybe tomorrow or however long it takes for these results to come in?
I think like everyone else, I'm watching to see if the upstart challengers to Richie Neal or Stephen Lynch can pull off a victory or keep it close. I doubt that victory is in the future for them. I think that the incumbents go in with a lot of strength. But we live in a topsy-turvy moment, and so it'd be really interesting to see if in fact they do. It would be a huge upset for them both, but whether they even keep it close. The results in the fourth, there's going to be a new member. That doesn't happen that often in Massachusetts, a new member of Congress, and so that'll be an exciting race to watch. And I think overall turnout, to see if we can't figure out, how voters are thinking about this fall. The numbers look like they're going to be pretty strong. The impact of early voting, the impact of the pandemic in general is something that has made these races a little more difficult to predict. Going into the final week, more than half of the votes had already been sent in. That's really unusual for Massachusetts. So, there's going to be a lot to unpack.
And that is Peter Ubertasio, Dean of Arts and Sciences at Stonehill College. Peter, it was great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great talking to you.
Between the pandemic, our country's reckoning with race, the current economic crisis, a high-stakes election year, there is so much going on, and it can be scary, and the convergence of it all can really be overwhelming. So let's check in on and with each other. We're starting our eighth month of the pandemic. The racial reckoning that began in May has intensified, as has the political climate, with the general election approaching. Many of us are grieving the losses of loved ones, jobs, opportunities, public figures, moments in life. And with so much going on, I want to ask, where are you? And how are you? Mentally, emotionally? How are you thinking about the outcomes of these intersecting factors and what happens next after November, after a vaccine? Maybe after federal aid runs out. Where do you think we're going? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. We've got two friends to join us and help have this conversation today. The first is Michael Curry, the former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP. Michael now works with the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and is a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And also with us is Meredith Goldstein, who runs the Boston Globe's Love Letters advice column and podcast. Meredith, welcome back to you.
Nice to be here.
All right, so let's think back, if you can even think back this far, to February, March, because, you know, time now. And let me ask, where are we and how have things changed? Meredith, why don't you start?
Oh, well, I mean, there have been so many interesting and strange phases of this. And I speak on behalf of, you know, letter writers, right? Like often I'm getting letters from people who are having relationship problems. So I have seen this very much from the perspective of spouses and single people who are isolated. You know, we've run a mental health series, video series, since the start of March. And of course, the problems we talked about at the end of March are completely different than the problems we talked about in June and July. So, you know, I think everyone has seen that this is a marathon, not a sprint. And with that comes so many different emotions. I mean, the most complicated questions to ask anyone right now is, how are you? Especially now as we move into fall and parents are negotiating school, as you heard. And so what I do think is we're still taking it day by day and trying to make meaning out of every day.
So, Michael, let me turn the complicated question to you. How are you?
You know, I think I'm like most Americans, feeling anxiety, feeling concern as we enter the fall and whether there's another surge of this COVID-19. You know, we're now looking at over 6 million, and I just want that to sit in for a minute, 6 million cases in this country and 183,000 plus deaths. We've not seen this before. And I think that has people concerned. As was said, as students are going back to school, as people are thinking about going back into their offices, as we're trying to get back to a normal life. And I think it's compounded. If you're African-American, if you're a person of color in this country, you're also on top of that, carrying the stress of this racial justice moment, as it seems that every week we're turning on our televisions and seeing a new police involved shooting, and we're waiting to see if America will finally respond in this moment in a just way. And I think we're, the jury's still out on whether America is ready to do the right thing.
I want to continue to invite listeners to join this conversation at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. It's time to be in community with each other, to be talking to each other, to be raising our thoughts, our fears, our hopes. And we hope you'll pull up a chair and join us in this conversation. And Michael and Meredith, I'm going to say to you, none of us can see each other. We're in three different places, and there is a sound lag when we broadcast remotely like this. But I really encourage you, talk to each other, interrupt each other or me. I wish we could all sit together at a kitchen table with a cup of coffee or a cup of tea and just work this through. And Meredith, to that point, how would you characterize what it is we're working through right now?
Oh my gosh, what a complicated question. I mean, it totally depends on who you are. I mean, you know, I think I try to find positives in this, right? And in terms of all of the social change and justice that we seek and seeing how this, you know, whole COVID epidemic has affected communities of color and how there's a reckoning as someone who is 43 and looks at younger people and older people and people my age and is seeing family members take to the streets in a way that perhaps they wouldn't have if everyone was working like normal and if the world were working like normal. I start to wonder if this confluence of circumstances will end with something positive. But, you know, I think the conversations change daily. It's hard to keep up with them. I mean, over the weekend, I talked about how, with so many people in my life, how about the death of a celebrity, right? This, you know, beautiful man who played Black Panther and
Chadwick Boseman.
Yes, and who changed the lives of people through his many roles, and particularly that one. Like, how do you grieve a celebrity death on top of so many things that are very real in our own lives at home? It's almost too much. And so, you know, I've just been trying to sort of navigate, I think, as everyone has, like, what can I do to be better? And what can I do to help the world be better while also doing whatever constitutes self-care? And I think along with that, there's a lot of guilt, you know, people who have kept jobs, people who have good health insurance, access to a car where they can drive through to get a COVID test. You know, I think anyone with privilege is thinking, well, what can I do? And how am I supposed to use that to help others? I'd like to think they're thinking that, but it's a really complicated time where sometimes even feeling good can feel bad.
And I just want to chime in, Meredith, because I think you're absolutely right. There's a piece you said that just sticks with me, which is whether we would have been here absent a pandemic. And I, you know, a good friend of mine, William Watkins, who's over at the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts, says something which I thought was powerful. He said, it took a pandemic and forcing us to stay at home with family and pay attention for us to have 2020 vision.
Yep, I agree.
It took a pandemic to force us to see racism in all aspects of society. It took us to see inequities in healthcare. And I just think that's powerful that it took us, we couldn't run out the door to get in our cars and have the drive time to work. We had to watch that shooting over and over again, or that knee on the neck. And I think that's where we are. I think the other piece that I think is critical here is there's a concern. You know, when I think about the militia that we're seeing play out in the last week or two, and we're seeing them all over the country, I have more African-Americans calling me saying, you know what, I think I need to get a gun license. Because if there ever were an incident, how would I protect my family? And if you talk to your Black friends across the country, you'll find that if they don't already have a gun license and they've been, you know, exercising their Second Amendment right, they're now having some real serious family conversations around getting one, whether the systems in their cities and towns allow them to get one without restrictions. And you'll find that that actually can play out along racial lines as well, when certain communities can't get a full license because they're considered high risk areas, like a Brockton or a Roxbury in Boston. So there's so much going on, and Chadwick Boseman's passing just sort of adds an extra weight on all of that.
You know, I want to stay on this, the gun portion for a minute, and I do later want to come back to Chadwick Boseman too, and so much loss in 2020. Christian Science Monitor says that women now make up 40% of first-time gun buyers, and that as gun sales hit historic highs amid the unrest this year, Black Americans represented 58% of gun purchases, outpacing all other groups. And we have a narrative about who gun buyers are, who Second Amendment supporters are, where gun culture is in America. And I want to sort out how to feel and think about what those changes signify. So Meredith, let me give you a chance to respond to all of that.
Well, I'm certainly no expert, but I think, you know, when I would imagine that when there is a shift in terms of who's buying, we have to consider why, right? What positions have we put people in to make them feel like this is the route they have to go and to protect their own families? And I think, I mean, gosh, to even to say the word militia, it's a word that it's a frightening, the whole concept is frightening. So I am not surprised we're seeing a different demographic of people who are saying this is a need, maybe not a want. Whereas I think perhaps my impression of a gun owner before that was someone who wanted that right, but didn't necessarily need. So, you know, I'm not surprised is all I can say.
So how scared are we? I mean, holy cow, Michael.
Yeah, I will tell you, and you know, I'm an activist, you know, I move in many different circles, and I'm terrified. I think we're at where the nation was in 1915 when D.W. Griffith put out Birth of a Nation, and there were tensions. There were 10,000 protesters, African-Americans marching on downtown Boston to the Tremont Theater to block the showing of that film, because that racist propaganda film would have had a disastrous effect on the politics and culture of America. And I think we're there again with a president who fans the flames of racism, with an empowered white Aryan Ku Klux Klan demographic that feels like they have a president in the White House, and they have some ability now to come out of the shadows. And it does terrify African Americans. I think of Ronald Reagan and the Black Panthers in, I believe, the 60s, when African Americans took up arms because they were concerned about police violence then. And it terrified America that African Americans were now arming themselves. And the reality is, we see white men often on our televisions arming themselves and marching on government buildings with no risk of military or police intervention. And wouldn't it shock America if large numbers of African Americans got their gun license at one time, had a run on licensing? And I think that that's happening. And I think it's going to test our whole notion of the Second Amendment when we see Black folks. It will tap into that racial fear that existed and was played out in Birth of a Nation.
Michael, I do want to point out the president has maintained a 40 to 45% approval rating. I understand the groups that you're talking about who are showing their strong support and showing up around the country. But I just want to note that the president's base is bigger than that. And that presents us with cross-community conversations we have to figure out how to have as well. It doesn't disprove other things you were saying, but it's a piece that I think we have to keep in the mix.
And I think it's important to know our history, and I don't just mean United States history, but world history, is that sometimes parties, sometimes populations of voters buy into something that they want out of a particular leader, but they don't buy into everything. But at some point, you're complicit with all of it. So I think what we have with Donald Trump, we've seen in other countries. We've seen in Russia. You've seen it across the globe. Where you'll have a leader who comes in and people make a deal with the devil, whether it's, I want you to deliver me a Supreme Court seat that will be conservative. I want you to deliver for me federal judgeships. I want you to fight back this LGBTQ, women's rights, say their name. And therefore, I'm gonna buy into that part of your rhetoric. But unfortunately, you take the whole bail away. It comes all with your support. And I think, yes, we have a diverse party within the Republican Party. But when I sit and talk to my Republican friends that I know, Black, white, and other, they're buying on to particular aspects of his presidency. But it's unfortunate because it empowers him.
There's so much more we could talk about there, but I haven't turned to the phones yet, and I want to. So 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's bring on Sonia from Framingham. Sonia, go ahead. You're on with our guests.
Well, thank you so much. And I just want to say what an outstanding program it is today and how much it resonates for me. Both of your speakers, I do want to say that given all of the issues that are in the forefront today, I believe still, no matter what, that there is hope. There is hope in youth. There is hope in the way in which young people are able to come together and look at things. I have two young sons. I enjoy so much discussing things with them and looking at their perspective. And I do think that we're in very dark days right now, but I do have hope for the future. And, you know, I just am newly retired, a teacher, just retired. And I just am thankful for all of the years that I fought and advocated for all of my students, African-American, limited English speakers, everyone who needed someone to be there for them. And I just do see that over the time period that younger people and through sorts of programming, restorative justice at the high school level in terms of looking at discipline.
Sonia, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Yeah, excellent. Thank you. And I love your message, and I want to take a chance to turn it back to our panelists, this message of hope. Meredith, how does that resonate with you in this moment, and where are we hearing people draw their hope?
So here's the one thing I would say about that. I love all of that. And I will say that now that I'm in my 40s, I see how I'm like, oh, the younger people. And I think that is true. But I think in order to make change, it's got to be all of us, right? It's not just a younger generation. I'm so excited when I see people my age, when I see older people who are pushing for necessary change, who aren't getting in the way, who are helping younger people do the work they want to do. Because I think generation after generation, we look to the young. And I think right now is an incredible time that we're all similarly on pause. And I get very excited when I see three generations of a family demanding the same kind of action. So that was my one thought during that. When I get very hopeful, it's because I see everyone coming together to push. And that's what gives me hope.
And if I could chime in on that, I think, you know, it's funny. I remember being a 20-something year old student in Minneapolis, St. Paul, marching over these same issues, over police violence in Minneapolis when I was a student there. I've been in many a protest across the country over the course of my lifetime, and I was young at that point. I'm worried that they'll eventually become cynical when they don't see justice for Breonna Taylor. All that activism and energy we see, we know how this works, is that people don't see justice, they don't see legislation passed, like the policing reform bill here in Massachusetts or the policing reform bill at the national level that's pending in Congress that might not ever get to the Senate. If we don't see that kind of progress, people will then tune out and they'll check out because they no longer have faith in the system. And I'm concerned about that younger generation. I'm excited about them. And to that teacher, Sonia, thank you for your service and the work that you do. But if we don't step up with them, because it's not them, it's actually us that sit in these seats. It's us that are city councilors, that are legislators, that are elected officials and corporate leaders and have the money and the resources to invest in progress. If we don't meet them where they are, they'll become us eventually. And we'll not see that progress.
Absolutely. And I say that as a member of the media that, you know, there are certainly young reporters and they do incredible work, but this takes, you know, an entire force of people to constantly be looking at things critically in all the right ways. And I think we all have to take that responsibility.
We have 30 seconds left, which is not quite enough to ask you each another question. But I do just want to ask, as briefly as we can, what's one thing people can do to rebuild in communities right now? Michael.
Yeah, I would say people are doing it. I've been on phones with Dunkin' Brands and BNY Mellon and all these organizations across the state and across the country that are asking their employees to have a conversation at work. I've been to schools. I've been to grade schools. This is the time to have the conversations, because if you can change minds, you can change the country.
Meredith, just 10, 15 seconds, you?
I think for me, it's learning that often when I'm uncomfortable as a white woman, it usually means I'm on the right track and getting there and talking to people about uncomfortable things to do the right thing. So.
Wow. I just want to thank you both so much. Meredith Goldstein, who runs the Boston Globe's Love Letters advice column and podcast, and Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.